Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is the Transformation of Value podcast. This show is brought to you by Swarbricks, the first law firm in New Zealand to accept Bitcoin for legal services. The Swarbricks team are Bitcoiners, and they are knowledgeable about the legal aspects of Bitcoin in New Zealand, as well as general legal advice. Swarbricks offers a 20% discount for services paid in Bitcoin. Find out more at swarbricks.co.nz/Bitcoin. Now, in today's episode, I talk with Dr. Matthew Birchall, a research fellow at the New Zealand Initiative. The New Zealand Initiative is a policy think tank conducting independent research on a wide range of issues. They interface with policymakers across the political spectrum, the business community, media, academics, and the public. Matthew wrote a report titled Paving the Way, Learning from New Zealand's Past to Build a Better Future. The report explores how the country effectively tackled infrastructure projects in the past and offers guidance on how the country can rediscover this talent. Topics we look at include embracing private enterprise instead of big government, drawing upon local knowledge and needs to guide infrastructure projects, and the importance for New Zealanders to rediscover the spirit of actually building things. Along the way, we discuss how these principles could be reactivated and some of the challenges they may bring with them. I do hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to get in touch with me, please send an email to hello@thetransformationofvalue.com and I will get back to you. Otherwise, on to the show. I've printed out a couple of reams of stuff, including your report.
Yeah.
Though you've kindly provided me a printed report of...
One for the shelf.
Thank you. Yeah. As you can see, I got a number of books boxed up behind me. But Matthew, welcome to the show, and thank you for coming into the studio today. I love doing these in person. If you had come last week, though, we would have been out of luck with the water was cut off. I don't know if that affected you at all with your office.
We were right, but it would have been quite sort of fitting given that we're going to be speaking about infrastructure.
That's right. You recently published a report, Paving the Way, Learning from New Zealand's Past to Build a Better Future, for the New Zealand Initiative. I would like to start, please, with a little bit about your background and what the New Zealand Initiative is about, please.
Sure thing. I'm the resident historian at the New Zealand Initiative. My background is in intellectual history and imperial history. I'd done my PhD at Cambridge, so sort of whiled away my better years of my 20s in archives and working on the sort of nuances of the New Zealand Company, which was responsible for colonising Wellington and another a bunch of the original settlements in New Zealand. Finished a postdoc, quite a short postdoc, during the lockdown in Auckland, and was sort of a little bit tired of, I guess, the cosseted academic life, so wanted to switch into public policy. And the New Zealand Initiative is a think tank, independent think tank, and we look at all sorts of issues from housing to monetary policy to healthcare, and I've slotted in there looking at infrastructure and now transport policy.
Yeah. So looking at independent research on policy,
yeah.
And the New Zealand Initiative is one of the leading think tanks for this kind of work, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I just look at my colleagues, Bryce Wilkinson, an economist who has an encyclopedic understanding of New Zealand economic history, Michael Johnston, a real sort of leader in terms of education policy, a cognitive psychologist, James Kierstead, trained classicist from Stanford looking at free speech issues and administrative bloat, our director Oliver Hartwich, who seemingly knows about everything, and Eric Crampton, our chief economist, who also seemingly knows about everything. So it's a small team, but we cover a broad array of topics.
Yeah, no, that's excellent, and it is important to note it is very bipartisan. You provide policy advice and information to everyone, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. So no fear and no favour. We just try to call it as it is.
Yeah, certainly a lot of great stuff available on there now, on your website there. Now, today, talking about paving the way, how did this report come about?
Mm. I think it's, you know, won't come as much of a surprise to any of your listeners that New Zealand has an infrastructure problem. I mean, we're talking about meeting last week and the pipes are blowing up in downtown Wellington, our capital city. And so it's clear that we have infrastructure issues, and they're very deep rooted. And, you know, so it seemed timely to sort of take stock about, you know, how did these problems arise? How did we get to where we're at today? Because, you know, you can only sort of pave the way forwards if you have an understanding of how we've gotten to where we are. So that was really the genesis of the report.
Yeah, so it's excellent. I was reading through it before. You do summarize it, though. You've got an excellent short article on the New Zealand Initiative titled Once We're Builders,
yeah,
which I think really is a play, obviously, on Once We're Warriors and some of the cultural ideas there around sort of our historical role mm-hmm. as a pioneer society that built yeah. a lot of great stuff. And in that that short sort of summary, you outlined a couple of things there, sort of your main points from the report. So I thought maybe we could go through those sort of one by one and sort of talk about what they mean and maybe have a bit of a discussion, if that's all right.
Sure.
So really your first one here was, your first, I guess, lesson from the report was about embracing the private sector. Mm-hmm. I mean, what does that mean for you?
Yeah, so I think too often, in the recent past at least, New Zealand has taken a top-down approach to thinking about infrastructure policy as opposed to a bottom-up approach. And, you know, this really taps into my second point on localism, which we'll address. But we expect government to solve our infrastructure dilemmas rather than actually delegating that, you know, decision-making capability to people who might be more equipped to deal with these things. And one of the interesting things in looking at the full sweep of New Zealand's infrastructure history from, you know, the period of Vogel right through to broadband, so there are lots of instances where we've embraced private enterprise. So yes, government, central government or local authorities can set a broad framework or strategy for how we think about infrastructure, but it doesn't mean that they have to deliver everything. And in the report I look at, you know, it's one of the stories I really love, the first bridge over the Waimakariri River, and it's literally just a chap called William White who sees the need for this bridge, and he actually stumps up his own cash, and the Canterbury Provincial Council says that's great, we don't have to do it, and he was able to get on with the job. You know, similarly, casting forwards to the rollout of broadband, I think that's a great example of government setting out a strategy for what it wants out of an infrastructure network, but it doesn't overstep the bounds, right? And so you then get private partners coming in and injecting that expertise, but also that capital. And if you sort of step back and think about the infrastructure challenge that New Zealand faces, it's a $210 billion deficit. So government can't do this on its own. We need to diversify how we go about solving these really knotty problems. And that's where, yeah, you need that sort of symbiotic relationship between government and private enterprise.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, I've got a similar, I guess, personal story, you know, with the Allingham family in Hawke's Bay in the 19th century, the original, you know, Allingham ancestor on the British side of the family had a small hotel in Te Awati in central Hawke's Bay, and they stumped up the money to metal the road. You know, from, I think, from Waipawa through to Te Awati. And that sort of was a great example of someone, just like your example there with the Waimakariri, of a private enterprise stepping up to actually pay for something.
Why? And it wasn't out of the ordinary. And this is, you know, the thing is, as a historian, I'm able to go and identify patterns in the past that we may have lost for now, but we haven't lost forever. And, you know, these stories that you're telling me, they're an integral part of our infrastructure heritage, and we can revive them today.
Yeah, and I guess following through on that, though, the idea of the, well, what is the role of government here? I think this is something I spoke about on a previous episode with Blair Walter about the future of renewable energy. You know, what is the direction and the leadership? Because as you say, I mean, you know, there is a need for, I think, directive or vision for what, you know, as a society, that, you know, where are we heading? However, is it the role of the state to allocate capital and to actually make the individual projects happen? Or is it more around facilitating, I guess, their visionary leadership, which can then be taken on by the private sector? Or is there no role for government in that at all?
That's a fantastic question, and I should just preface my response by saying just earlier today, we've got the leaders of, not all the leaders, but many of the leaders of our political parties are debating New Zealand's long-term infrastructure challenge. I think it's arranged by Stuff and Infrastructure New Zealand. It's a complex question. Whenever you talk about infrastructure, people always say the big thing that we need is this long-term vision.
And the five-year plan.
Yeah, the five-year plan, the 10-year plan, the 30, you name it. And it kind of sounds quite sensible and fairly benign, but there are a couple of problems with that. One is people disagree about what this plan should entail. And secondly, politicians have a different set of incentives, right? So what may sort of suit them, you know, in Wellington may not necessarily be best, you know, in the best interests of New Zealanders when we're thinking about our network. So I'm a little bit sort of skeptical about this big picture thinking when it's not matched by really hard-nosed analysis in terms of how we're going to fund and finance things. I think in terms of the New Zealand debate, we're actually in a much better position here than I think many people realize. And kudos here to Waihanga, the New Zealand Infrastructure Commission. I think they're doing a fantastic job in terms of outlining a pipeline of work. They're producing really good quality research, much of it informed my report, but they're at arm's length from the state, from the government, I should say. And I think that's important because one of the arguments that I hear crop up with some frequency is that we need a new Ministry of Works. And I like to say, well, you know, the problem with the first Ministry of Works is it didn't work. And I don't think that's a model that we want to go back to. So I think in terms of the long-term strategy, I don't see it as a particularly pressing issue. I think there are other problems that we face.
And I guess to that point as well, you know, long-term big picture thinking, you know, brings to mind things like Think Big.
Yeah.
And, you know, the near bankruptcy of the country through projects which, you know, were misallocations of capital. And in the same vein, I mean, I've got a copy of The Road to Serfdom there on the table, and you look at, I mean, you know, quite far on one end, but the idea that, you know, the state cannot allocate any capital effectively whatsoever, so it should simply not bother, and the individual actors and perhaps localism, which we'll get to in your second point, is really the way forward. If there's a bridge that needs to be built somewhere, it's probably better for those people to make that decision instead of Wellington.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I have two chapters that in the report that really act as cautionary tales. First is Julius Vogel and the creation of our rail network. And the second, as you allude to, is Muldoon. And, you know, these are very much sort of mixed appraisals. I think Vogel was more successful than Muldoon, although it's not that hard to beat. But yeah, the sort of the problem that's sort of elucidated by both of these case studies is government wasn't really in a position to sort of understand exactly what needed to be done. You know, it couldn't necessarily pull all the right levers, and it took on all the risk. And the problem with that is, well, if it goes bad, it goes really bad. And we saw that quite dramatically with Think Big. And you know, I worry about this in the context of New Zealand's infrastructure deficit, because people talk about, oh, we just need to build stuff, we're way behind. And, you know, you name it, whether it's roads, hospitals, pipes, whatever, it's not in good nick. But, you know, that doesn't mean that the solution to that is for Wellington to step in and, you know, take on huge amounts of debt, because we know from our own history and also the history from overseas that that can end quite poorly.
I've got one more sort of piece on that private enterprise. Are you familiar with the writing of Joe Studwell?
No.
So I read, actually, when I was in Thailand the time before this, I found one of his books sitting there on a pile of junk, which was quite funny. But it was it's a book called How Asia Works, Success and Failure in the World's Most Dynamic Region. And he's done quite a bit of writing. He did, I think, Asian Godfathers, looking at...
I know the book you're alluding to. I've not read it, but yeah, I've come across the title.
Asian Tigers, looking at the emergence of these, you know, places like Hong Kong or Singapore. But I guess my question for you is, leaving things up to the private sector, what is the role, I guess, of protectionism, in the sense that New Zealand doesn't have very deep capital markets, and so big investment, no doubt, will require overseas capital to build. What does that mean for New Zealand? You know, is it a Belt and Road type thing where we become indebted in the private sector to overseas investors and that sort of thing? Like, a few different things in area, but like, I mean, how do you approach that sort of idea of capital markets?
Sure, it's a great question, and something actually that the New Zealand Initiative has done a bit of work on recently. My colleague Bryce Wilkinson, who I mentioned at the start, is bringing up graphs that, you know, track everything about the New Zealand economy, and one of his findings of late has been that New Zealand ranks very, very poorly in terms of foreign direct investment. So we're very closed, and you know, this has an impact on us because, as you mentioned, we're small. We don't have those deep capital markets, so we need to be doing everything we can to attract capital. And I know the podcast you did with Blair, he spoke about you know, the sort of capital there in Canadian pension funds. So I think the orientation for us needs to be absolutely open to capital, also open to new ideas, open to labor. However, Belt and Road, absolutely not. And I think that's where you're rubbing up against security concerns. And I think, you know, the sort of the overriding ambition for New Zealand should be to be open to the world, to be internationalist, to get the best talent and capital, but to have a clear sense of values and what's in the national interest. And Belt and Road, I don't think aligns with the strategic direction that we want to go. And there are these, as you note, these sort of problems that you can get into in terms of debt, and we've seen this I think most notably in Sri Lanka, but also closer to home.
Yeah, well, coming back to this book that I mean, I remember, just it was boiling hot summer, you know, rainy season in Thailand a couple of years ago, and I remember just reading the whole thing cover to cover and being blown away. And effectively, so Joe Studwell's book How Asia Works, really, it was a case study of the successes and the failures within Asia post-World War II. And really, you know, you look at the success stories of Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, excluding the microstates of Hong Kong and Singapore. And then you look at some of the, you know, I guess failures you see with somewhere like Malaysia, the Philippines, Thailand, which arguably after World War II, all of these countries were in a similar state. But the difference was that Japan, South Korea, Taiwan had very protectionist economic policies, policies of land land reform, export discipline, and a few other things, whereas Malaysia, Philippines, Thailand opened up their capital markets, and arguably the financial crisis in Thailand, or the Asian financial crisis in 1997, was driven by this kind of foreign influx of investment in housing, unproductive assets. And a lot of these places were also, factories were set up, but they were international. You know, there's no, you know, Korean and Japanese, Korea and Japan were able to manufacture cars and high technology, whereas, you know, it was more around manufacturing and assembly of foreign owned goods in these other places. And I guess what my question to you around is, you know, if New Zealand as a whole becomes as a small country, is it vulnerable to overseas investment in an extractive sense, and how do we navigate that?
I don't think so. I think, you know, it's important to look at starting places, and, you know, I'd be much, I think the Asian case studies that you illuminate are fascinating for all sorts of reasons. But, you know, New Zealand in 2023 isn't, you know, starting as a Southeast Asian country trying to rebuild after World War II. And so I'd actually look at a place like Ireland, which has done really well in terms of attracting foreign direct investment. And coincidentally, its infrastructure is in rude health. So I think, you know, these international comparisons always need to be made, because they make you think and you learn new things. But there are limits to them, and I don't see, you know, the sort of the close map between, say, New Zealand now and Malaysia. You know, I don't know enough about, say, Malaysia, but, you know, its racial politics, for instance, are very, very different. Similarly with Thailand. So, you know, our sort of regulatory and constitutional cultures are very different as well. So I think on the balance, I see upsides for us being open and attracting capital and talent, provided that we have a clear sense of what our values are.
I think that's a really good point, that I can see what you mean. Like, I think the sort of the second half of that book that I mentioned really talked about the transition, though, out of that protectionist export discipline phase, you know. So, you know, the Taiwan was, you know, they were manufacturing semiconductors, but they're still living in hovels, effectively. But there was a transition period for all of these countries where they eventually did have to open up, and that protectionism did have to fall away. And it had incubated. It was sort of like a nursery. It had incubated and protected itself from just the ravages of global capital. But
quite at some point, you have to join the world. And, you know, look at our own history from the sort of 1890s onwards. We develop this economy that's really dependent on our imperial links to Britain. So, you know, we're sending, you know, butter and dairy products to the home country, as it was known. So that was a sort of, you know, protectionist, imperial protectionist type of economy. But, you know, was that sustainable? Well, we didn't really have a choice in that, because the empire starts to disintegrate. But yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, arguably, maybe we've had that moment. And I mean, for our lifetimes, I mean, all we've known is modern New Zealand, whereas, you know, talk to my grandparents, we talk to older people about the old days, and, you know, even something like the Ministry of Works. I mean, it's a quaint idea. You know, you can find old New Zealand Film Commission footage of, you know, Mangakino or some of these dam building projects, and it's unrecognizable.
It is. I mean, I was always so touched by it. You put it well. It was quaint. But yeah, I was born in 1991, and I just I can't sort of recognize this country. I mean, I think deep down it's been passed through culturally, right? The sort of number eight wire mentality and that kind of sense that we're still a small country and we get on with things, but so far removed from, you know, how I grew up in Auckland.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting. So I was on recently actually back in Thailand for a business trip, and I was part of a delegation talking to a man there who's a very successful businessman from New Zealand who I was on the delegation with. And we were talking about, you know, he was quite a lot older and talking about some of that neoliberal reform. And he said, you know, look, Roger Douglas, it was the best thing that ever happened to New Zealand, pulling the Band-Aid off relatively quickly on agricultural subsidies, which were what, you know, we were looking at agri-tech in Thailand. And it was painful. A lot of people got, you know, got taken out with that. But that led to us being this very competitive global exporter of agricultural commodities, you know, and there's no subsidy there. And that, in a way, a lot of those reforms led to the success and the bountiful New Zealand we have today. Because, I talked to my grandmother and she says, you know, when she was growing up, there was no warehouse, there was no farmers, there was no international brands. It was one shop for everything. And that, I mean, that, again, the quaintness.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable if you wanted to go overseas, you know, in order to get some money out, you had to sort of go to the bank in New Zealand and plead your case.
Yeah, there was a very good documentary, which I'll link to in the notes, looking at the Longy government and that era.
Oh, is that Revolution?
It could be. It's like a four-part
Revolution. Really fantastic. Some cracking suits as well. Yeah. The fashion of the time
in the 70s and 80s. Okay, so that's cool. So that's looking at the private, you know, embracing the private sector. But coming to your next point, locals know best. Tell me more about that.
So I think, you know, points one and two really go well together, right? Private enterprise and localism. And, you know, I just come back to this, the point that I led off with, which is we now sort of expect government to solve everything. And we've neutered the power of local authorities to get on and build the things that we need. I mean, just this morning I'm reading a story about the rebuild, you know, horrific rebuild on the East Coast. And it's, you know, the common theme that comes up is we're waiting for Waka Kotahi to delegate, you know, the necessary funds and to get on with things. And I went there recently. I'm an avid surfer, and I went out to Gisborne, and you know, the unifying thing was we dislike Waka Kotahi. You know, so I'm trying to get a coffee, and it's a bit late, and it's Waka Kotahi's fault. Everything is Waka Kotahi's fault, and I think that's a product of tilting the scales really far towards centralization and away from localism. And it really only comes to the fore when we have, you know, big problem like recovery from cyclone. And, you know, looking at our past, we weren't always so centralized. And one of the stories that I think exemplifies our localist spirit is the Auckland Harbour Bridge, which was a special purpose authority. And this is something that was led by the mayor of Auckland, John Allam, quite a sort of charismatic, indefatigable figure. And, you know, the people of Auckland were able to shape their infrastructure future, right? You go back, talk about long-term planning. It's the people who, you know, are going to be using and benefiting from the kit that are making the decisions. And I now look at Auckland, and you have, you know, parties and rival parties in Wellington saying, oh, we want this type of bridge, and we want three lanes doing this and five lanes doing that, and seemingly no consultation with local authorities. And so I think the balance there is wrong. So like, you know, point one, private enterprise versus central government spending, I think the balance is wrong there. I think, yeah, the balance between localism and centralization is also wrong.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it becomes political, but you talk about something like the under the grand title of Three Waters, and I mean, I don't know a single person outside of Wellington who supports that program. In particular, you know, myself coming, you know, from Hawke's Bay, you know, everyone is against it, and there's an argument, almost a paternalism, of you know, Wellington knows best, and I mean, you know, I went to school in Hawke's Bay, where they had the Havelock North contamination issue, and at the same time, you know, we had our pipes breaking here in Wellington, and somehow it's used as this kind of you know, evidence that something needs to be done, as opposed to the fact, which was there was stuff that wasn't maintained in a certain area, which caused issues. But there's a lot of parts of New Zealand that have very well maintained water infrastructure.
I think that's right. It's you know, if you're assessing the water network through New Zealand, you know, it's very much a patchwork thing. So if you look at, say, how Auckland have maintained their water assets very well, you know, as you know, not the case in Wellington. And I think the larger issue is just the default is to revert to centralization. And, you know, we've seen this with healthcare as well. We've seen this with politics, and I think it's a sort of knee-jerk reaction that I think it doesn't really stack up, and the promise is always we'll have you know, efficiencies of scale, whatever it is, but that never really eventuates, and so the deeper problems are around, you know, things like asset management.
Yeah, well, that efficiency often in any scale of economy, I imagine, is gobbled up by the bureaucracy of the mega ministries that are operating here. And again, the politics of it, you know, going through the the cyclone and my family being personally affected by that, there's certainly issues. It feels like a lot of the regional councils are, you know, kind of on their last legs and very thin on the ground, you know. Certainly the Central Hawke's Bay Council, you know, where my family is, and that is, you could argue that they're useless, and that a lot of their mistakes and the issues with the flooding and that in Central Hawke's Bay were because of council mismanagement, along with obviously the natural disaster side of it. But it's kind of a chicken and egg, because we're like, what was it, because the local governments were underpowered to start with?
Quite. I always face this problem when I go out to barrack for localism, because people say, well, my local council is useless, to which I say, well, okay, you're probably right, but
doesn't mean we should scrap it.
They're useless for a reason, because this, you know, the relationship between central government and local government is such that they can't really be effective, you know, whereas in the past the settings were different and they were quite good. But yeah, it's a tough battle to have, because people sort of look out the window and think, oh, well, our council's useless. Why are you wanting to advocate for more localism?
Well, I mean, arguably, though, I mean, Central Hawke's Bay, the Hawke's Bay Regional Council, Horizons, I mean, they're still relatively small compared to something like Environment Canterbury, which I think certainly has a degree of professionalism to it. And it's just got that slightly larger population, slightly larger area, that it is able to undertake initiatives which are very, you know, they've got a little bit more legs to them than that. And so it's almost like finding that sweet spot.
It's not a one size fits all. And so when I talk about the need for localism, not everything has to be localist. Let's find out what works, what doesn't. But the knee-jerk reaction that centralization will solve everything, I think is misplaced. So I had the good fortune of chatting to someone recently from Environment Canterbury, and, you know, incredibly professional and across the issues, and they seem to be doing a good job. But
I wonder how much of this as well, and this kind of grazes, though doesn't completely touch the Bitcoin thing, is the fiscal responsibility of local government, because they have to run a tight balance sheet.
That's right.
They either have the money or they don't.
Yeah.
And our central government, however, may print to their heart's content. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a really big issue. And my colleague, Eric Crampton, has written a lot about this. The incentives right now for local government, and this actually touches on the next point about the culture of growth, is they'll do anything to avoid it, right? Yeah. Because they have very rigid fiscal requirements, and they see the downsides to growth and not the positives. Whereas, as you say, central government, it's a sort of different picture, and I think that just distorts how things are done.
Yeah, I think that distortion in the market, in a way, it's actually quite predatory, because, you know, take Three Waters, for example. You know, the local councils are having to be very austere and, yep, and tight with their spending. And it's easy enough for central government to come in and say, look, we'll fix everything. But that results in, you know, cost of making a single meal at home, going grocery shopping, and, yep, you know, you can't even get anything, you know, $6 bottles of milk and all of these kind of cost of living things that we've got through inflation. So it's like, the central government is able to say that they can do all of these things because they're not financially accountable, because they can always go...
Well, yeah, they're not accountable right now, and they can kind of fudge it, right?
Yeah, or they can just go across the road to the Reserve Bank and quite get the printers going, you know?
I went, you're talking about cost of food, I went to the supermarket yesterday evening and I thought, oh, I'd quite like some blueberries for my breakfast tomorrow. Little punnet of blueberries... $15.
Yeah. That said, though, I want to blame central government for everything, though I know for a fact that our blueberries, especially from Hawke's Bay, were very heavily affected.
There you go. There you go. I
think that's an outlier, right, though.
Yeah, it did seem like an outlier. I didn't know that they were from Hawke's Bay.
A lot of them are, yeah. Yeah, though, I think we can't blame Gabriel for everything forever. Certainly there will be a time when that's no longer an excuse, and I think the broader trend of inflation through money printing is really a big, I mean, everyone I know is impacted by it directly in their daily life.
And COVID is another one that's used as a bit of a smokescreen for poor decisions. So if you look at, and here I'm really leaning on my colleague Bryce Wilkinson's work again, he'd done a lot of work around PREFU last week, and if you look at New Zealand's you know, the fiscal position from 2017, before COVID, government was spending a lot. Now COVID changes things, right? Because all of a sudden you're dealing with very uncertain risk, and you know, the time pressure as well is such that, okay, you have to do something very quickly, and so I think you can forgive a bit of how should we put it, a bit of latitude. You can give them a bit of latitude there, but what has been concerning is, and this is, I should point out, this is the government, this is not Reserve Bank, because there are other issues there, but you know, you really need to speak to people like Michael Riddell and Eric Crampton, who have documented this well. But on the fiscal side, that spending has continued after the threat of COVID has really neutralized, and that's really problematic.
Yeah. Just a little bit on PREFU. Can you just detail what that is for the listeners and what it means?
Yeah. So this is the pre-election fiscal update. And I believe it was brought in by Ruth Richardson. And the reason it's brought in is because we'd had a couple of instances where governments would get the keys to the beehive, and all of a sudden they would find that the books were in a far worse shape than they thought, and so the sort of classic example, I guess, is
the
Longy government. Yeah. This is...
I had to float the dollar straight away.
Yeah, it's quite amazing when you read about these sort of calls being made on Sunday morning and stuff, and you've got to get in here right away because we're really stuffed. And I think it... it's a really healthy thing for our democracy to have that transparency, right? I think it's one thing to have the transparency, but the more sort of concerning thing is the politics that is now going on around PREFU. So you'll have serious commentators weighing in on, you know, this is what this means and this is what that means, but political parties have now gotten used to how to message around PREFU, and so you'll have to make this sort of bipartisan, you'll have Robertson saying, oh, this is actually quite good. I mean, the guy's never run a surplus, right? And it's not a good picture when you get into the nitty-gritty, but you know, on the flip side, you have National saying this by no means changes our plans for tax cuts and our fiscal strategy, which is also nonsense. And so I think, yeah, we have political theatre around PREFU, which is a concerning trend.
Yeah, certainly. I can attest that there is certainly a lot of political theatre going on. Though, coming to your final point in the report, talking about culture and the imperative for New Zealand and New Zealanders to rediscover the spirit of construction, enterprise building, I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so it's my third point, but I think in some ways it's the most important point. I'm so struck... now looking at infrastructure policy, if I put on my sort of 2023 hat as opposed to my 1883 hat, some of the big issues around how we deliver infrastructure hinge on the amount that it costs to consult, to get consent. Taken in isolation, some of these things kind of make sense, right? Like, okay, you don't want to completely destroy the environment or be culturally insensitive. But when you lump everything together, it means that it's impossible to get things done. And the example that I come back to, I'm from Auckland, and when you're flying to Wellington, you're just flying over reams of land, right? And so I looked how much of New Zealand is built on. 1%. We have a country larger than Britain. We have, what, 5.5 million people? I think last I looked, Britain probably had 70 million. And we have a housing crisis. That is just absurd. And when you look at it in a really sober way, reading the reports by the Infrastructure Commission, you can track when New Zealand becomes unaffordable for housing. It maps on with a rise of planning and regulation. And so, you know, this legislation, there may have been nice intentions behind it, but it's really clear when you look at the evidence that this has stuffed things up. And why it's a tragedy is, okay, if you just looked at housing in isolation, okay, that's a real failure of public policy, right? We've just created conditions which mean that we can't, produce enough houses, and we once could. That's a problem, but the real issue is that that's at the root of our really serious social and educational problems. So that public policy predilection to make things difficult then means that young Kiwi kids have, you know, a tough time getting ahead. You're closing down talent, and that's that's a real tragedy. And, you know, when I looked at state housing, which is, you know, many New Zealanders will know these iconic images of Michael Joseph Savage, you know, going into 12 Fife Lane and with the table, and you know, really iconic on the left, and that's kind of used as an argument for massive state intervention. That's only part of the picture. I mean, the reason that the state was able to build houses is because they didn't have those constraints, so they could actually build houses, and they could collaborate with the private sector. You know, fast forward to Kiwi Build, same sort of animating spirit, but the culture is such that all the rules and regulations that are in place mean that you can't do what the first Labor government did. It's impossible.
Well, it's a different paradigm. And you mentioned 12 Fife Lane. That's over in Miramar, isn't it?
Correct.
Nearby, yeah. The first state house in New Zealand. Was it 1939 or?
Something like that.
It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you're aware, but you could see that photo up on the wall behind you. I've actually got a background. I do a lot of photography.
Fantastic.
Yeah, one of my other jobs. And I've been very interested in capturing that idea of the New Zealand home. And something that always struck me is that, you know, the image of a New Zealand home is still the state house, is still the villa, it's still the native timber. It hasn't innovated. And I mean, maybe Christchurch is a bit of an exception, but for the most part, anywhere you go in New Zealand, it's dilapidated stock that is uninhabitable by most standards around the world. You know, Europeans or Americans come here and they think this is pathetic. You know, you've got holes in the walls and black
mold. Not proper insulation.
No, yeah. What is insulation?
I mean, yeah, there's a point where something that used to be sort of pride of place becomes a bit of an indictment on a society. And I mean, we can chat a lot about this because I also have a real fascination with New Zealand's built heritage. And this is something that as I was writing this report, one of the pleasures was starting to see the landscape in a different way, and looking at the different, you know, phases of our architectural history. I don't know if you've ever read Ben Schrader's The Big Smoke.
Yeah, so I've spoken with Ben about some of my photographic work, but do tell me more.
Yeah, so I drew very heavily on his work on state housing. So I don't know where he's based at the moment, but I think
he's in Wellington usually.
Yeah, but I think he was based for a long time at Ministry of Culture and Heritage, but he wrote a book on state housing many years ago, which is a fantastic resource. But his more recent piece is I suppose more thematic history of New Zealanders and how they've occupied urban spaces. Because, you know, I mentioned on this, you know, the flight from Auckland to Wellington, you're just going over empty space. And there's this weird disjuncture between the myth of New Zealand, which is, you know, rural, this kind of Fred Dagg, gumbooted black singlet guy mucking around on the farm. There's a disjuncture between that and how many New Zealanders live and have always lived, which you know, is an urban, totally concentrated urban spaces. And Ben does a fantastic job of looking into these, you know, sort of the alleys and the byways of our urban spaces to show how we've done life, done work, school in cities.
Well, it's sort of the nation building project of rural New Zealand, which, you know, I certainly have an affinity with growing up there. However, if you look at the history of say Wellington City and Te Aro in particular, was the most densely populated place in New Zealand for many years.
That's right. I mean, it's quite similar to how Australians conceive of their country. If you think about it, it's the outback, but it's one of the most densely, you know, you can't live in many places in Australia because it's so darn hot.
Yeah.
So everyone's sort of dotted around the coast. But yeah, like any sort of good Kiwi, I think for me, there's something about getting out into the country that speaks to me. But the reality is I spend 95% of my time in a place like Wellington.
Well, yeah, I mean, also coming back to that identity piece, I mean, I've spoken on other shows around sort of my troubles with the idea even of the nation state. And I think this transition, I mean, we've seen the transition from empire colony through to, you know, dominion. And now we're going through, I think, a similar transition away from the nation state. I mean, certainly my affinity with New Zealand Inc. and in particular the New Zealand government is very strained. However, you know, like what is New Zealand? Maybe it almost comes back to your second point. It's where you're from. You know, if you're an Aucklander or if you're from Hawke's Bay or you're from Canterbury, I mean, your lived experience is going to be quite different. You know, certainly, you know, Central Hawke's Bay and Ponsonby are worlds apart. And trying to lump that all under the title of New Zealand, I think, is challenging. And I mean, it's a collective hallucination.
I mean, it's always nation building is always a work in progress. And I think it shouldn't be an easy fit. I think it, you know, going back to our point about localism and centralization, finding the balance there is difficult, and central government needs to listen to local government, and local government needs to, you know, have a good conversation with central government. And it's that conversation that I think is at the heart of you know, building a nation that's hopefully prosperous and open and a good place to live.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully, I agree. I mean, there is certainly, I would like to see a resurgence in New Zealand. I mean, you talk about nation building. In a way, I look at the nation deconstruction that's taking place. And I mean, again, coming back to this idea of reigniting the passion for building, whether it's the nation building project or building houses or infrastructure, what is needed to drive that? Because I sort of look at the provinces, I look at, you know, Hawke's Bay, for example, and just really the lack of leadership, the lack of ambition, and the regulation that sort of stifles that. I don't know. I think things get a lot worse before they start getting better. What are the pathways ahead, though?
I think that's right. You know, you mentioned the reforms of the 80s earlier, and I feel like we're at a similar sort of moment where, you know, let's be frank, the prognosis is not great. You know, I've had the pleasure of spending a lot of my you know, adult life in you know, lovely sort of elite educational spaces, and coming back to New Zealand and slotting into our university sector and now at the Initiative, and learning from my colleague Michael Johnston at just how poor we're doing. You know, if you're not educating your country properly, you're going to feel that impact in, you know, 20, 30 years. And it's a little bit like infrastructure. It takes, you know, it's a slow sort of accretion of an issue, and then it gets really problematic. And putting my historian's hat on here, you know, for a long time, New Zealand, we were able to be very successful as a small country, but part of the reason was we had low productivity, but we could always bank on our human capital. And one of the issues that I see now is I don't think that holds any longer. And, you know, the world doesn't owe us a living. And I think we're going to go through a pretty dicey period unless we have that kind of appetite for serious structural reform.
So you're talking about structural reform. I've certainly got you know, ideas around what that could mean. Obviously, as you know, when I reached out to you, you know, this show is looking at Bitcoin. It's looking at kind of the broader I guess role of fiat money printing, monetary policy, and how that has this kind of long-term you know, this long-term effect on the economy and on a nation state's kind of existence, and perhaps some of the transitions that are coming down range. And I just look at the neoliberal reforms or the move away from empire. What is the next thing? Because I think from my perspective and my reading, the idea of, you know, the welfare state of good old New Zealand, Kāinga Ora, MPI, all of these institutions that have taken on almost a religious role. You know, they've become, you know, the government is everything for everyone in this country at the moment. Is that coming to an end? And are we going to enter a period where massive austerity is the only option? How unpalatable is that going to be? What is the role? I mean, looking at, I mean, this is going a bit beyond, but looking at the current account deficit and some of these other issues, I mean, what is the future of the nation?
It's clear that, I mean, that's a big question, but it's clear that we've overextended ourselves in terms of what the government, you know, is doing and should be doing. And it's going to require structural reform to roll that back. You know, so to take one example that I think is screaming out but hasn't really received enough attention is healthcare. You know, which is odd because we've just come through a pandemic. But often it's the thing that was most sort of alarming. You know, it's right in front of you that you kind of unable to take a really hard-headed look at it. But the system is clearly set up in a way that, okay, it may have worked, you know, in that sort of mid-20th century sort of quaint time that we're talking about. But, you know, it ain't working now. And look at, you know, what's happening with the NHS in Britain. And I think sometimes countries can become sort of captured by their own myths, right? And so, yeah, some of the harder questions that we need to ask ourselves when we're, say, looking at healthcare policy is, okay, what is it worth paying for this principle that we hold really dear, right, which is sort of universal healthcare? And when you start asking those questions, it can lead you to questioning some of those underlying assumptions.
Yeah, I think that's where I've come to, like, with New Zealand, you know, the New Zealand project, certainly become, and honestly, I think that the COVID era really set off a lot of these questions for me, but just the mismanagement, the way that the New Zealand government tried to map itself onto this culture, these southern islands and these people that happen to live here, for me really just, it was very problematic. And I mean, to be honest, yeah, I don't have a GP, I don't get sick. And I tell my friends and family, look, let's just not get sick, because if you ever have to go to the hospital, you're going to wait 10 hours. And if you have to go to a GP, it's going to take you 2 weeks. So it's such a dire state. And yet I can go to Thailand or anywhere else in the world where I've traveled and go and see a doctor pretty much straight away. And I pay for that. And it's like those two worlds are so far apart. New Zealand is the third world country in that conversation.
Yeah, well, we're certainly moving down in that direction. And, you know, I would say, I think in healthcare, I'm a doctor's son, so I have to sort of barrack for the medical profession a little bit. But, you know, the problem is not the quality of our medical professionals.
No, they're high quality.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
The problem is the policy settings and the fact that we don't have enough. And there's not enough flexibility in the system. And I'll just point listeners to a recent report by adjunct fellows Murray Horn and Des Gorman of the New Zealand Initiative that's looked at specifically our GPs. But yeah, it's a problem, but it's not just you know, healthcare. It's infrastructure. It's education. It's we've just taken this kind of block mentality to solve what are really difficult issues.
That's right. So I guess, I mean, we've got these sort of three major points, or, you know, major topics within your report: the idea of embracing the private sector, localism, and you know, deferring to locals and to places, and not just managing it all centrally. And then reigniting the passion for building. So We've got all of those, and then this kind of idea of structural reform, though balancing that with the idea that, or balancing that with the political theatre that's currently taking place, you know, I certainly don't see any structural reform coming out of that play. Where does the structural reform come from? Is it you and I, or is it the people? Like, where is the Ruth Richardson or the Roger Douglas of 2023? Who are they? Do they even exist? Can they exist in this political environment?
Yeah, I had a very sobering chat with Michael Bassett about this very question. And, you know, I'm pretty relatively new to New Zealand history. I've really studied world history and European intellectual history. And Michael Bassett is not new to New Zealand history. And I asked a very earnest question, which was, you know, it just seems that New Zealand is only ever capable of reforming when, you know, the proverbial hits the fan, when it gets really, really bad. And Michael sort of paused for a moment and said, that's about right. And I don't know what sort of causes that. And there's a sort of deep kind of cultural explanation, I think, but it feels about right, but it doesn't have to be that way. And all I would say is, you know, the New Zealand Initiative has a whole suite of policy proposals, and we have it all laid out on our library wall. And you know,
the answers.
Yeah, and a reform. You know, a lot of these things are not. We make them difficult. They need not be. But I guess that's politics. But to sort of add a, I know you're looking for a solution here, but as a historian, I want to layer in complexity. I think the challenge now is harder than it was in the 80s. And why I say that is the reforms of the 80s were, in some respects, addressing very technical questions, right? And so the solutions were technical. So you know you bring in GST and you do all these things, or Treasury and the government do all these things. But I look at New Zealand now and I think, okay, the economic prognosis is, we're not quite you know, where we were there, but the structural sort of outlook is bad. But in addition to that, we have cultural issues. And when you combine the two, that makes it very hard to sort of set a clear policy direction. And I think we're seeing that in this election. You know, I think if I look at the two party leaders, you know, both Luxon and Hipkins, they don't seem like nasty people at all. Actually, I think they're probably both quite nice. But the tenor of the campaign has been kind of squabbling over things. And that's kind of baked into New Zealand politics in a way that suggests that, yeah, things aren't as they should be. And I think, you know, you just have to look at issues like, you know, the COVID mandates. I think that's a wound there. Debates over co-governance, you know, even things like Posey Parker's trip. These types of cultural episodes are occurring quite frequently in New Zealand, and it's been amplified by digital technologies. And so we're sort of inhabiting different kind of worlds, but, you know, the underlying world that we all inhabit is that everything's really expensive and it's not quite working.
And the water pipes are broken.
Yeah.
And the roads have potholes. Yeah,
exactly. And when you're dealing with that kind of, you know, to go back to the sort of infrastructure, to use a kind of infrastructure metaphor, the landscape is riven with potholes and burst pipes. And, you know, people are going to be angry when they're driving to work and they're hitting a pothole, or walking to work and water's spraying on them. And that's kind of where I I see where we're at. So we need, yeah, some pretty good mechanics to kind of patch it up.
Heads down and forge ahead with doing the work, proof of work. I guess maybe a closing topic, which I guess is something that I'm really trying to explore with this and this podcast and with my other episodes. You know, you talk about your study of history, New Zealand history. In your experience, what has the role been, the nature of money meant to some of these early developments? You know, if we look at colonial New Zealand, we look at, Britain, in the historical context, how does money, sound money, gold standard, these kinds of ideas, which you may be familiar with, how does that influence the development of infrastructure, the investment that goes into infrastructure? Do you have any just general thoughts on that and what we can learn from that?
That's a really, I've never thought about that question, and I'm quite struck by it because my PhD thesis, we mentioned this before we came on air, looked at British joint stock colonization companies, including the New Zealand company. And I was really interested in the social network of the City of London. So the merchants, the bankers, the accountants who composed these companies. And quite incredible when you think about it, because they sat around a boardroom table in London and said, we want to go out to this place that, you know, Europeans haven't settled before. And they had such little information, about, they're quite literally going to James Cook's voyages and saying, oh, yes, like this part of the country is like that. But that was the sort of financial backing behind the colonization of New Zealand. And they were responsible, as I mentioned earlier, to the establishment of our first towns. And for a long time, New Zealand's financial system, is quite reliant on the City of London. And so, specifically in terms of infrastructure, Julius Vogel, who had strong ties to London, actually ended up going back to London to become a novelist after he built our rail network. He was borrowing on the London markets. So that's always been an important source of capital for us. In terms of how that develops through the 20th century, I don't know in as much detail as I would like. It sounds like a fantastic topic for a financial history MA or PhD. I mean, it's one of the things about New Zealand history. When you take on, say, a broad topic like I have, history of infrastructure, you realize, okay, the thesis on this more discrete topic hasn't been written. So I can't really weigh in terms of the role of sort of sound money and how that's influenced our infrastructure, but certainly something to think more about.
Yeah, no, I mean, it could be a provocation for future research or investigation, because I think that certainly has been a real eye-opener for me, understanding the history of say the gold standard and how money and sound money, kind of the nature of it changes the way it's used. And when money is abundant and easy to print, you can go and blow it on anything, and the population pays for it through inflation. However, if you really do have to run a tight budget, arguably in a way that the regional councils do, they have to be a little bit more specific and conservative, and there's maybe trade-offs with that.
Yeah, quite. And, I'm always harping on to people about how we need to know more history. But, you know, I think we really, really need to know more economic and financial history. And, you know, you'll occasionally hear calls for increased financial literacy. I would love it if, you know, students learnt a little bit about the history of money, and so we could have a more sophisticated debate around these topics.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hey, look, Matthew, I really appreciate your time, and thank you again for the copy of your report, Paving the Way. I will link to the digital version as well and some of the topics we've discussed. But in terms of your writing, your work with the New Zealand Initiative, where would you like to send the listeners, or if they want to learn more, is there a place where they can go to follow you?
Yeah, a couple of things. So first thing would be to go to the New Zealand Initiative website, just type us in, and all our reports are there. We also have a weekly podcast, and I would implore everyone to subscribe to our weekly insights newsletter. I'm writing a column this week, and trust me, we really slave over these columns. They're only, you get three of them, 400 words, but we put a lot of work into them. You know, as I mentioned earlier, it's such a pleasure to be working with, you know, seriously smart people who think deeply about New Zealand and the big issues that that face us, and that sort of, that just gets distilled into three short 400 word snippets and an essential Friday read, I would say, Cody.
Yeah, sure. Cool. All right, Matthew, thank you very much.
Cheers. Thank you, Cody.
Thank you for listening. I do hope you enjoyed the show. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you'd like to get in touch, please send me an email at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com, and I will get back to you.